The cyber landscape is constantly evolving, creating new challenges and opportunities to defend against sophisticated attacks. At Northrop Grumman, we provide a wide range of capabilities to stay ahead of these threats. To learn more, visit northropgrumman.com/cyber.
Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report's weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. I'm your host, Vago Mouradian, and joining us today is Josh Laspinoso, the co-founder and CEO of the cybersecurity firm Shift 5, a West Point graduate who spent 15 years as an Army cyber professional and another 10 years with a national security agency, who is also a Rhodes Scholar with a PhD from Oxford University in statistics and author of the book C++ Crash Course. Josh, it's a pleasure having you on.
Vago, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. And before we get started, our daily podcast is sponsored by Bell. Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our coverage of naval warfare. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Josh, SolarWinds attack has obviously put the issue of the security of the, or I should say cybersecurity supply chain issues in sharp focus. President Biden is sanctioning Russian officials. There's more to come as this investigation continues about what exactly Moscow did, right? I mean, was it a pure intelligence gathering operation, which may be okay under the rules, or were there leave behinds and other, changed data and everything that people worry about? There are hints that actually there could be a little bit of that. But obviously, that investigation is ongoing. President Biden also has signed a cybersecurity, the supply chain security executive order. But there is a far, far bigger issue. There are literally billions and billions of chips, not to sound a little bit like Carl Sagan, right, that are in everything from platforms to weapon systems to pumps on nuclear aircraft carriers, all the way to cell phones, cars, toasters, refrigerators. How big of a problem is this? Because we have a tendency of talking about defense in terms of network security, but Each one of these component parts is also a vulnerability, right?
Sure.
How big of a vulnerability is this across both the commercial, but especially on the defense side of the ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, not to sound like Chicken Little, but I think there is no bigger cybersecurity problem in our lifetime. These systems, military weapon systems, civilian critical infrastructure, all of these things that make modern life possible or defend, our freedom. We've seen this trend over the past, three or four decades where the manufacturers of these systems have migrated analog components into much smarter digital components because it just makes so much sense to do it. The digital components are more reliable, more robust. There's a larger field of engineering talent to design these things. They're cheaper and they're sort of future-proofed because you can upgrade them. So what manufacturer wouldn't start accreting digital components into a system? Of course, the double-edged sword here is that because these components are digital and increasingly run software and can be updated and have pretty complicated operating states, it opens up this huge attack surface for adversaries to get in there and take control of these systems or subvert their operation or put the crew and the operators or the people that depend on these systems at risk. And because these digital components, as you mentioned, come from such a long supply chain of value-added manufacturers that take inputs from somewhere up the chain and modify them to, either write software for it or integrate a circuit into a larger system of electronics. These supply chains get really complicated, and it's very, very, very difficult, if not impossible, to get provenance for all of these systems. So, you as the end user, whether that's the Department of Defense or it's a commercial locomotive operator IoT devices in your home, it's very difficult to know whether some nefarious actor inserted themselves into this supply chain and potentially put you at serious risk.
It's interesting. I should have pointed out, right, that a lot of these chips do come from China, and some of these components even come from China that have made it into our weapon systems, in part because we do not have necessarily the supply chain. I mean, right now, right? I mean, Ford and General Motors trucks are, you know, vehicle production is slowing down because of chip shortages. Yeah. And I should say, full disclosure, right? I mean, your company does some of these kinds of work in, mm-hmm. from both the assessment side as well as the remediation side of things. But tell the audience, Josh, even systems that we think are the most secure actually don't take a lot of hacking to get into. So tell the audience, right, that some of this stuff is just not secure and vulnerable, right? So I might not be able to get into the combat system of a ship, but I may be able to stop the ship, right? Yep. Okay, well, in a world of hypersonic and precision area denial systems, right, that's kind of problematic. I can sink you.
Sure is.
You know, so how easy is it from the standpoint of a cyber professional to get into systems that we may actually perceive as secure, but may actually be remarkably unsecure?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most, I think, interesting things about military weapon systems is, you know, you would make the assumption that these things are incredibly secure because they're, number one, extremely expensive assets, but they are critical for the Department of Defense to accomplish its mission. And unfortunately, the case is quite different. You know, I would say that, for example, an Apple iPhone is highly secure. It's actually very difficult to subvert, you know, something like an iPhone or a MacBook or even a fully patched Windows 10 system, because there's so many security professionals that have been banging on these systems for years and years and years. And there's an ecosystem of bug bounties and security engineers who are, you know, we call them white hat hackers, who look at these things day in and day out. You don't have to take my word for it. You can read the Government Accountability Office's 2018 report that summarized some of the cybersecurity risk assessments that, you know, me and my co-founders used to do against military weapon systems. You know, they've taken some of the really classified details out of it and summarized them into a sort of hypothetical abstract weapon system. But I mean, to hear them say it, this is one of the most devastating and large national security crises of our time. I mean, these systems, you know, they were designed over time with increasing amounts of digital components, but no one designed them from first principles with cybersecurity in mind. And it wasn't on the minds of the folks that put the contracts and the requirements together for these systems to build cybersecurity resiliency into them. We're seeing that today. Thankfully, there are a lot of really smart government officials who have cybersecurity background that are getting involved in the requirements process for these systems. But I'll tell you, you know, we probably did a half dozen of these cybersecurity risk assessments against various weapon systems in the DoD inventory. And it was never a question of whether we were going to be able to get in. It was a question of how many hours was it going to take us and how bad is the effect going to be, which is, it really is mind-boggling for folks that might otherwise think that these systems are totally secure.
And how much time are we talking about, and how mind-boggling are the implications?
As bad as you can think. You know, I mean, these systems, number one, again, were just designed with this sort of eggshell, what we call eggshell security in the security community. So this is, you basically try to harden the shell and make it hard for people to gain access onto a system. But then once someone has that access, you are fundamentally trusting. It's like a friend zone inside of the system. Right. So once you gain that initial foothold, it's basically like, okay, well, read the manual and what do you want to do with this system? It doesn't even require really like bespoke chains of exploits like it would for you to go from, say, someone clicking a link in their email on their iPhone all the way to, you know, getting execution on their device. So typically the most challenging thing for us, which, you know, to be clear, was a matter of, you know, hours or days typically, was how do we gain initial access onto these systems. And, you know, the GAO report shows you all kinds of different possibilities here. One, which you've mentioned, Vago, is the supply chain issue, right? So supposing someone gets into either the software or hardware supply chain of a weapon system, that solves the access problem. You've gone in through the side door, so to speak. There are issues with personal electronic devices and the, you know, pilots and crews of weapon systems being in proximity to the weapon system that creates big access vectors. You've got issues of maintenance personnel. So typically with these multi-million dollar or billion dollar systems, you know, you're plugging maintenance support devices and firmware upgrade devices directly onto these platforms to do diagnostics, to make sure that the system is running the way it's supposed to be running, or to upgrade configurations and software on that system. Well, those devices oftentimes become access vectors. And, you know, because cybersecurity is sort of an afterthought, oftentimes we would find that the cryptographic measures that people put in place were really security theater. They were not difficult to subvert at all. So, you know, I could go on and on and on with these initial access vectors. I will tell you that we've shown, and red teams have shown time and time again, that eggshell security is just a really, really dicey proposition. And what you need to do, like we, you know, it's almost ironic because the Department of Defense invented defense in depth, right? Like when we think about defending something, you always have layers of defenses, and you trade space for time when an attacker is coming at you. But we aren't doing this with our weapon systems, and we need to be doing that. We need to be putting layers of defenses in so that when a compromise happens, which invariably it will, we find out quickly, and we can remediate and reconstitute firepower, and we can kick the adversary off of the system and figure out how to harden the system so that it that doesn't happen again.
So let me take you to the question of how exactly we go about doing it, right? I mean, I love your, you know, you may have a pristine F-35. Maybe F-35 is not a good example to use, but you could have a new weapon system, but then you plug it into an old maintenance computer, right? Or a diagnostic computer, yeah. Or hey, the main, you know, the unit we have doesn't work, so we'll plug a backup older one in, and guess what, right? You have a new attack vector there. And right there isn't an airplane or a ship that you're not on where people have their iPhones, people have their Apple watches and whatnot, yep. Right? I mean, the vulnerability of Fitbits, right? Where people were tracking where special operators were around the world using them. I mean, there's all sorts of ways of using this stuff. You talked a little bit about how we address the problem. This is a vast, vast problem. You know, our sponsor, Northrop Grumman, is one of the companies that has been talking about doing, you know, cyber from the beginning as a core attribute. It looks like a lot of modern weapon systems, whether it's the B-21, NGAD, a lot of other systems are being built with this in the forefront. You're part of the Force Point team. I think you developed Red Owl, if I remember correctly. That Raytheon bought with great fanfare in 2017, you know, when Tom Kennedy was also talking about the importance of building systems from scratch. The fact is, that's great for the future. How, Josh, do we do this for past, right? For the stuff that's in inventory, what's the way to do this? And what is a realistic time frame? Or do we need to figure out some way to operate knowing, right? I mean, I don't even, I just don't even know how to wrap my mind around the fixing part of it, since everything has chips in it now.
Yeah, that's totally right. And I mean, you've put your fingers on the pulse of a really important problem here. You know, unlike IT systems, a server or a personal laptop or a cell phone, you know, which maybe you get 2, 3, maybe 5 years of useful life out of, and then you retire it and you buy a new system. These operational technology systems, military weapon systems, locomotives, commercial aircraft, maritime vessels, these things are in service for decades and decades and decades. And so you've got technology out there from the 80s, 90s, early 2000s that isn't going anywhere. It does its job well and faithfully. And we're going to continue to operate those systems for decades more. And so it is so critical that, yes, we design cybersecurity requirements into the new systems and we start solving this problem from first principles, absolutely. But we have to go back and look at these legacy systems and fix them as well, because, you know, there are just too many. There's trillions of dollars of these assets out there. So the cybersecurity community, I think, around OT, operational technology, is burgeoning, but there are a lot of really, really smart, talented folks that are solving different complementary parts of this problem. And so I think the cybersecurity community could rapidly deploy solutions onto these weapon systems in a matter of months or low numbers of years. So relatively very rapidly. The problem in the DoD really is the procurement cycle. And you know, I'm sure you've heard time and time again from smaller players in the space and small companies that want to do business with the DoD. But procurement is really the reason that we're not seeing a lot of America's innovation engine applied against these problems. And I'm not the only one who, you know, thinks a lot about this issue. There are, you know, really important efforts inside of the DoD to try to get procurement on a time span and to a scale that works for venture-backed startups. And, you know, things like AF Ventures and AFWorks and, you know, Army Futures Command and the SBIR programs and OTAs, all of these are really important efforts to get rapid prototyping to solve critical problems like cybersecurity, and you know, many other kind of frontier of technology types of approaches, and bring those into the DoD to solve real critical national security problems. Where, you know, companies like Shift 5, where we're looking to and where we're hoping for help from the government is to say, okay, well, we're going to do these rapid prototyping events and we're going to get these rapid prototyping contracts to start showing how we can secure these systems. The big question for us is, okay, well, how do we field this to 5,000 Stryker combat vehicles or to a fleet of C-130s? What sort of contracting mechanisms and rapid procurement can we use to get those kinds of efforts funded? So I guess, you know, the good news is that the cybersecurity community and the tech community is ready and waiting to solve these problems. And I think they are so achievable and doable, as complicated as it sounds. They're very achievable goals. The challenge really is, how will the DoD design procurement mechanisms to keep up with the rapid pace of innovation that the companies rising to the challenge are going to be moving at?
Is this hardware replacement? I mean, I used to remember one of the challenges with like 8086, you know, you talked about 1980s, yeah, right? Let's take a flash to the past, right? I mean, 8086 mm-hmm. chips, 486 chips. Yep. There's a lot of those around, actually, yep, a lot more than I think people recognize. And one of the challenges is, right, the speed of the chip is an issue. You can solve it with software, but once a weapon is certified, putting a brand new chip in it that operates at light speed is problematic, right? Because sure, the circuit goes, well, wait a minute, I need it to take that long. And right, you've just cut that into a microsecond, right?
You got it.
So, yeah, is this pulling chips out, putting new chips in? Right. Because then you've got like a whole series of other challenges because form, fit and function. And yep. Right. I mean, how do you address part of this? And the reason I ask this, Josh, is right. I mean, Apple went to the new generation of chips, and Ars Technica had a story that 30,000 of these new chips could have stuff on it that could only have originated from a nation state, yep, that could manipulate the chip and then have a disappearing feature to it, right? Another nation state hallmark. And people are scratching their heads and saying, like, hang on, Apple's got really good security. How did this happen, right? So, right. I mean, how much of this is just sort of, you know, certify clean chips, put clean chips in, right? I mean, how does the mechanics of this work?
It's really tough. So, first off, I'll say, I think it is kind of, in general, it will be very difficult for us to go back to legacy systems and start ripping out subsystems and redesigning data buses. You might as well, it's going to be so expensive and difficult to do. You might as well just replace the whole weapon system with something brand new, because it's going to be just as expensive to completely re-engineer the way things work. And so what's required are elegant solutions that we can sit on the side of a functioning platform to augment what's already going on. And so one of the things that, you know, not to be too self-promoting, but one of the things that, you know, we work on at Shift 5 is intrusion detection systems, right? This is an easy win. So to the defense in depth concept, you know, do everything you can to put security control measures in place and stop breaches when they happen, or make breaches less severe when they occur. But the other thing is, like, figure out when they happen, because right now if there were these breaches going on weapon systems or on locomotives or aircraft, we just wouldn't know about it until it was too late. We wouldn't have any idea that these things, that there's an intrusion on these systems. And so one of the things that we focus a lot on is bolting intrusion detection onto the side of these systems and making sure that they still function in entirely the way that they were designed, but now they're instrumented and we can do things like say, wow, you know, this system is operating outside of baseline, or we're seeing activity that indicates that an adversary is pre-positioning malware on different subsystems mm-hmm. on this bus. And then we can go and remediate it before it's in service. So I think techniques like that and other complementary kind of bolts on the side techniques that don't replace the way that the system fundamentally works, that's the way we have to go after these legacy weapon systems.
Two questions before we've got to wrap.
Sure.
How big of a financial problem is this, right? I mean, is this, you know, and is this something that the direction of resources toward is going to solve, right? Like it's $35 billion. And if yeah. we did that in a year, we can tackle this, right? I mean, because it would seem to me that if you're going up against a two very savvy nation state opponents with formidable cyber capabilities, who in their doctrine have said, we will use all tools to incapacitate you, right? So how do you prioritize it? Sure. And how much money would be needed, right, to get to this? I'm not asking, maybe I'm asking your yeah. market.
No, no,
look. Question, right? But I mean,
yeah. I mean, look, I think for legacy systems, you're talking with respect to the cost that would be incurred for replacing an entire weapon system. You're talking about, a hundredth of the cost of that in financing to build robust cybersecurity features onto the side of these legacy weapon systems. I mean, it's a totally achievable problem, and it can be done with very reasonable amounts of money. And I think what the DoD needs to do is make sort of risk mitigation versus cost trade-offs. And so things that are relatively cheap to do, like putting intrusion detection onto a platform, we should be doing those things, you know, rather than completely redesigning the way something works, for example. And I'll tell you, one of the other interesting things that we've found is that by doing modernization of these systems, by adding things like intrusion detection systems, there's actually an opportunity to reduce costs for platforms. So we found, for example, that by listening to these devices, by putting taps onto all of the data networks on these weapon systems, on locomotives, on aircraft, we can pull this data back and then actually use it for maintenance and operational insights, as well as to detect cyber intrusions. And in a lot of cases for our commercial customers, we've been actually able to be profitable for these operators because we're giving them data streams that they've never had before from these assets and allowing them to be smarter and safer with the way that they operate. So I actually think that there are some interesting opportunities for the DoD to be cost neutral or cost savings in smartly introducing some of these digital modernization techniques that include cybersecurity onto the platforms. But, you know, the short answer is I think with, you know, relatively small amounts of capital that fit well within the maintenance budgets of a lot of these programs of record, you know, directing those towards cybersecurity solutions, we could really, really go a long way towards solving, you know, answering the GAO's call to action for defending the cybersecurity of these weapon systems.
We've got about less than a minute left. Two questions, right? We had Chris Cleary, the Navy's principal cyber advisor on the program last week. And he said, look, I mean, we're still working this, right? Everybody you talk to, they're still working it, and it's very earnest, and it is like eating an elephant. What kind of strategy do we need, and how does the president's executive order maybe play into this, right? Because I think everybody is trying to eat this elephant by themselves, and at some point everybody's got to put the bib on, Josh, and get out the hot sauce and start eating, right? I mean, is it for lack of sort of a macro plan? Does DISA have to, like, who what's the throat that has to be responsible for doing this, and how does the president's executive order play into a better ecosystem?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the president's executive order is a huge step in the right direction. It's a, you know, let's figure out what the heck is going on here and gather data. Let's be a sensor here and figure out what the lay of the land looks like with respect to the supply chain problems. And then we're going to take that data and make smart decisions on how we improve, because it's a complicated issue, right? So I think it's a really smart approach to trying to solve that problem. I think in general, there are so many facets to this. I mean, one is just recruiting and retaining cybersecurity talent to serve in the DoD, whether that's, you know, contractors, active duty, it's government, civilians. Because if we don't have a strong backbone of cybersecurity professionals on the government side, you know, the private space can do whatever it wants, but ultimately the products and services that they're offering are just not going to get integrated into a cohesively smart strategy on the federal side. And, you know, to be clear, I think there are some tremendously talented cybersecurity professionals filling the ranks in the government, but that has to be a paramount concern. I know there's a lot of work that's gone in, you know, the cyberspace Solarium, and the DoD is working really hard on some programs to hire and retain cybersecurity talent. That's a huge problem. And then, you know, going back to the procurement issues, just continuing to make big progress on how the government procures services and products from really innovative companies out in the private space. The combination of those two things, I think, are at an, you know, sort of tactical operational level, really important. And then, you know, look, I see a lot of really promising cybersecurity strategy coming out. But to your point, I think there needs to be overarching cybersecurity strategies for the administration that integrate all of these pieces together to make sure that we're not duplicating effort and that also we're not missing anything.
Josh, thanks so very much for spending so much time with us. Really appreciate it and look forward to having you back on again in the future. Best of luck.
Thank you so much, and I'd love to come back.
Everyone is a contributor at Northrop Grumman, and every day is an opportunity to help defend our nation and our allies. Visit our careers page at ngc.com to learn about joining the Cyber and Intelligence Mission Solutions team.